Well, if you've been worshiping here for a while, this slide motif will look familiar to you. It's been a while, but we're going to be thinking about a song this morning, a song that we just had sung just a moment ago. 1 Corinthians chapter 14 is certainly in the midst of the great letter on worship. You think about worship and all the things that we're supposed to do in worship. 1 Corinthians definitely is heavily focused on that idea of worshiping God correctly. In 1 Corinthians 14, verse 15, we're told to sing basically with two things in mind. We're to sing with the spirit and with the understanding. And for this reason, this would suggest that our singing is not merely an act of worship, although certainly it is, and that is the preeminent idea behind it. It is also a teaching exercise. And Colossians chapter 3, verse 16 talks about that. Colossians 3, verse 16 says, "Let the word of Christ richly dwell within you with all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with thankfulness in your hearts to God." So this would add more into that, or it would dive into what exactly 1 Corinthians 14, 15 is talking about when it says to sing with both the spirit and the mind. There is a thankful spirit that is to accompany our singing. There is certainly the idea of teaching and admonishing that is to be focused on that as well. And there are basically goals to which our singing is to aim. And so thinking about those things and keeping those in mind, it is very important for us to understand the lyrics of the song and the intent of the song that we are singing. Because it's very easy to fall into the trap of singing in a very rote manner. What was the first song that we sang in worship this morning? Just about 10 minutes ago. Do you remember what it was? "I Stand in Awe of You." And then the second one? "One Day." "One Day." See, it's very easy to sing through something and follow the slides or follow along in the book. But it can be very easy to fall into this rote sort of singing. And so to think about what we are singing, why we are singing it, to be teaching and admonishing one another, and to be learning as we are singing is very important. So for that reason, we're thinking about this song that was written by George Duffield, Stand Up for Jesus. And no doubt the inspiration behind this, as we'll discuss, is from Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6 says to basically take our stand for God against the battle that we are engaged in against Satan. It certainly is beautiful, and it is an inspirational song. It has found its place in the hearts of millions of people and hundreds of hymnals, according to my research. And it has encouraged many to take their stand for the Lord. So let's think for a moment about the background story. This is Dudley Ting. Dudley Ting was an Episcopalian preacher, and the song is inspired by his life and his teaching. Dudley Ting, of course, was a friend of George Duffield, and so he was inspired by his friend. Dudley Ting was bold, he was fearless, he was uncompromising, as you can tell by his beard and his haircut. He was uncompromising. His preaching was very strong. It was, in fact, too strong for the Episcopal Church, and so he was forced to resign, actually, for speaking out against slavery just prior to the Civil War. He was forced to resign. He then organized the Church of the Covenant, is what he called it, in Philadelphia. And they would have services at around noon each day in a YMCA. And there would be large crowds that would gather. And on one particular time, in one particular service, he said this in his sermon: "I would rather that this right arm were amputated at the trunk than that I should come short of my duty in delivering God's message." The month following, there was an accident. He was watching a corn shelling machine and watching the operation of it, and suddenly his arm got caught in the machine. And after loss of blood and shock, he died on April 19th, 1858. And on his deathbed, he said, "Let us all stand for Jesus." George Duffield, of course, was inspired by that. George Duffield's in the top right here. He gives this tribute, this moving tribute, in a funeral sermon for his friend. And he spoke about Ephesians chapter 6, particularly verse 14, but I would encourage you to read this whole section of text with me, Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 18. Ephesians 6, verse 10 says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm. Stand firm, therefore, having girded your loins with truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. In addition to all, taking up the shield of faith, with which you will be able to extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. With all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit, and with this in view, be on the alert for all perseverance and petition for all the saints." And after he had spoken on Ephesians 6 and verse 14, and read this poem that he wrote, actually the lyrics for our song, somebody took that poem and set it to a tune that was already established, a tune called "'Tis Dawn, the Lark is Singing." So in our hymnals, you'll have the name of George Duffield, and you'll also have the name of George Webb. George Webb actually wrote this song for a secular, kind of like a carnival atmosphere. So it's interesting to know that that tune is actually matched here with such a powerful and moving song. Duffield didn't even know that his poem was set to music. He didn't know until years later when he was visiting a Union army during the Civil War in 1864, and he heard the soldiers singing, stand up for Jesus. All this, of course, being inspired by his friend who preached against slavery. So let's think about the song. Verse 1 says, stand up for Jesus. Ye soldiers of the cross, lift high his royal banner. It must not suffer loss. From victory unto victory, his army shall he lead, till every foe is vanquished and Christ is Lord indeed. Again, we just sang that not too long ago. And the power behind that tells us basically that we are to learn that we must stand up for Jesus because we're soldiers of the cross. We are soldiers. This is not a social activity. This is not just for fun that we gather together. We are worshiping and we are living as soldiers of the cross. The Christian is a soldier in the Lord's army. Phelan stole a little bit of my thunder Wednesday night in talking about this idea of being a soldier. But I'll reiterate once more what he was talking about. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3 says, "Suffer hardship with me as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. No soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier." And if anyone competes as an athlete, he moves into a different metaphor. Now, a lot of Christians, one preacher once said, that a lot of preachers approach evangelism and approach discipleship kind of like somebody would approach the beaches of Normandy with a lawn chair. We are to stand as soldiers of the cross. We are to fight as soldiers of the cross. One characteristic of a good soldier is his willingness to endure hardship. We just celebrated the 75th anniversary of that storming of the beaches. Suffering hardship, seeing friends by the wayside and pressing on, fighting despite all the miserable discomforts that the world may throw at you, enduring hardship to accomplish God's purpose. A good soldier always seeks to please the one who enlisted him, as this text tells us. And of course, Christ is the ultimate one who has enlisted us. We are a soldier in the Lord's army, and that's how we are to approach discipleship, not as people storming the beaches of Normandy with lawn chairs. A soldier of Christ is told in this verse and in the Bible that we must lift high his royal banner. Banner is a very kind of antiquated term for a flag, a battle flag. And so we are to lift high this battle flag. And although probably most of us are not used to being soldiers, the soldiers in our audience would recognize this idea that you keep the flag flying at all times and pressing forward. The loyal soldier will risk his life for the banner. And we must show the world that we are happy to serve and defend the truth of the risen Lord. For Romans chapter 1 verse 16 says, "The gospel is the power of God unto salvation." It's not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to save face behind. It's something to stand and hold high. To our last dying breath, the flag must fly. I don't know if you have watched the movie The Patriot, but you can recall Mel Gibson with the flag at the end of the movie, waving the flag, pressing against the enemy. The flag must fly, and our life must be charged by that. Many don't respect the authority of the great commander in our world, and they want to do as they wish. They want to fly their own flag. They wish to establish their own plan, erect their own church, march under their own banner that cannot be. We march under the flag of the cross of Jesus. It says, his army shall he lead. It doesn't say my army, I will lead. It says, his army shall he lead. The Lord is our leader. He is our forerunner. He is our commanding officer, to use the soldier metaphor. And we have to follow his lead. You remember the scene at the Mount of Transfiguration? Jesus is speaking with the Father. It's such an overwhelming scene. The apostles that are there, Peter, James, and John. Peter says, let us build tabernacles. Because there's this instance that leads before Jesus and his Father speaking with Elijah and Moses and Jesus. Peter says, let's build three tabernacles for these three men. You remember what the Father says, though? He says, this is my beloved Son. Listen to him. It's his army. It's his lead. He is the commanding officer. So we need to stand and march following Jesus. Verse 2 says, stand up for Jesus. The trumpet call, obey. Forth to the mighty conflict. In this his glorious day. Ye that are men, now serve him against unnumbered foes. Your courage rise with danger, and strength to strength oppose. Verse 2 tells us we need to stand for Jesus because there is a mighty conflict to fight. This is a fight. This is a battle. This is war. And we need to keep that in mind. That needs to be in the forefront of our mind. We have an enemy, and that enemy is powerful, and that enemy has cohorts behind him. It is a conflict to death. And if he wins, it is eternal death. We have to fight, and we have to resist. As James says, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Obey the call to battle, and go forth to the mighty conflict, this verse says in the song. And the Christian's weapon really is the sword of the Spirit. A lot of that text in Ephesians 6 is revolved around this idea of defensive measures. And we have the breastplate of righteousness, and the helmet of salvation, the feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace, belt of truth girding our loins. We have all these defensive measures, but it also talks about an offensive measure. It says the sword of the Spirit, wielding that sword. We have to fight because it is a good fight to fight. Paul, towards the end of his life, told Timothy in 1 Timothy 1, verse 8, to fight the good fight of faith. Or as some translations say, war the good warfare. And towards the end of his life, in 2 Timothy 4, Paul tells Timothy, I have fought the good fight, and I have finished. It is a fight of faith. And we have to take courage because of that. We have to believe in the Lord's causes, because if we don't do that, it's not worth fighting, is it? There has to be motivation. There has to be an implicit motivation there. There has to be something intrinsic to our spirits that causes us to fight for the Lord. And our strength is in him. Take your stand in the Lord, Paul told the Ephesian brethren. The psalmist spoke of that in Psalm 31. Psalm 31 and verse 24. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who hope in the Lord. Now, earlier on, he talks about the fact that God had trained his hands for battle. This is David writing that. God has trained us, and he's given us all the measures that we need to fight in this fight of faith. But we have to remember to take courage. We have to recall why we are fighting this. As Joshua was about to undertake the perilous task of taking Canaan, the giants, the iron chariots, what did God tell him? Be strong and courageous, over and over again. And then he told the people the same thing. Many want to be soldiers. They like the glitz, they like the glamour, they like the idea of bravery or courage. But they don't want to fight. They like the uniform, but they won't wield the weapon and press the battle and endure hardship. And so that's why we're told to arise like soldiers of Christ. That's why we're told to be valiant in battle. That's why we're told, like in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13, to be like men. Ladies, there's a way of understanding that too. Being strong, being a soldier, being valiant, enduring hardship. We can all connect to that idea. Verse 3 says, stand up for Jesus, stand in his strength alone. The arm of flesh will fail you, you dare not trust your own. Put on the gospel armor, each piece put on with prayer, where duty calls or danger, be never wanting there. The idea of lacking. This is a picture from World War I. Running in the trenches and fighting. Coming out of those trenches against gunfire. Fighting. Verse 3 tells us, teaches us, to be ready always when duty calls. That's what we're teaching each other when we're singing verse 3 of this song. We're telling each other to be ready, to be vigilant. Because the soldier of Christ must always be vigilant. When duty calls, regardless of the danger or the price to pay, we must be eager to pay that price. In Titus chapter 3 and verse 1, Paul writes to Titus and he says, remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to always be ready for every good deed. Always ready. Paul in Acts chapter 21 says that he was ready to die for the Lord if the duty called for it. And it would later on. He would be released from that first imprisonment, but he would be arrested again and he would be beheaded as a Roman citizen for preaching the gospel of Christ. He was ready. You think about the concept of duty. We've kind of lost that. It's fallen on hard times lately. Soldiers' medals that are found in a drawer are just kind of cast aside or thrown away to Goodwill. We've lost contact with that idea of duty. Even among God's people, some kind of resent having obligations. Do I have to do this? It should never be a matter of do I have to do this or can I find a way out? It should always be, I get to do this. I am blessed to do this. We think about Solomon and his exploration of everything. He says the whole duty of man is to fear God and to keep his commandments. The Lord says basically the same thing in Luke 17 and verse 10, to follow after him. To keep him first and foremost. Not to let things detract us or distract us or beset us. Really, no more needs to be said in regards to that. It's very plain. It's very simple to see. That's the whole duty of man. That's what we are to cling to. Flowing out of our duty to God is our duty to his church. If we are soldiers of Christ, we're not only fighting in the world, but we're also fighting against the hostilities that press in against the church. And some that arise within the church sometimes. Are we fighting those things? Are we stimulating one another to love and good deeds? Are we reaching a oneness of mind, a oneness of judgment, a oneness of spirit? Are we, who are spiritual, restoring those who get beset by sin? Are we reaching out our hands to those who are wounded on the battlefield? Phelan talked about that again Wednesday night, and I pray that we have been thinking about that. Are we reaching out and are we fighting against the enemy, or are we fighting against ourselves? Verse 4 says, stand up for Jesus, the strife will not be long. This day the noise of battle, the next the victor's song. To him that overcometh, the crown of life shall be, he with the King of glory shall live eternally. Verse 4 tells us that we have to stand up for Jesus if we want to win the victory and receive the crown. I love this example, and I cite it often, but Polycarp, he's one of the early people in the church. He's a very influential person in the city of Smyrna, actually. And there's been a lot of kind of debate about things, but certainly he was devoted. He was very zealous and passionate. He was given the opportunity to recant of the name of Christ after the threat of death, and he told them that, "I have served the Lord for 80 years. How could I betray him now?" That was an old soldier in the war. Somebody who could have been discouraged, somebody who had plenty of opportunity to renounce Jesus, and he didn't. He was a faithful soldier in the battle. We need to keep in mind that victory is assured. And it's not just the message of Revelation, you know, Christ wins. It's the message of the whole Bible. It's the message of the battle. It's the message of the war. Victory is assured. Those who do not stand up for Jesus will not receive the victor's crown. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10 says to be faithful until death, and he will give us a crown of life. What an incredible promise that is given to us. That if we stay faithful, that if we keep in mind that the victory is already assured, that there is a crown awaiting us, that we can be with Christ. Another image that's given here in the New Testament is over in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Remember earlier we talked in 2 Timothy 2 about how there's this idea of being a soldier, and being a farmer, being an athlete. Well, here we have this idea of an athlete. And keep in mind that Corinth is here in this place where they have the Isthmian Games, which is kind of like the Olympics, a very kind of earlier on version of that. This Isthmian Games, where you would see these races that were run against these athletes, and this metaphor would mean a whole lot to them. Hopefully it means a lot to us as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 24 says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win." And this goes completely against this idea that we're all winners, doesn't it? Run that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. They were given these olive leaves. You know what happens to olive leaves in about 3 days? They're dead. The crown was dead in 3 days. It was gone. That was a perishable wreath. This an imperishable. If one is not faithful in little things, will he be faithful when his life is on the line? You can't be faithful in your attendance. You can't be faithful in your involvement in the church. If you're given the opportunity to recant Christ and that your life is on the line. This crown is the victor's crown. It will not wither. It will not fade. It will not tarnish. It is a crown of life. It is a crown of righteousness, and it is a crown of glory. That is worth fighting for. That is a victory that is assured. We're reminded in this fourth verse of stand up for Jesus, that the strife will not be long. Sometimes it feels unbearably long. The kids are sick right now. Last night was a long night. A very long night. And they were sick about a month ago too. Spent like 3 nights being up with them. That felt like the longest thing ever. That felt like one of the most difficult challenges in the world. Even though at times our spiritual battle may feel incredibly long, keep in mind that we are just a vapor. That even if we live to be 70, 80, 90, 100 years old, that is still a vapor. Because what we are fighting for is eternity. And 70, 80, 90 years, in contrast to eternity, there's no comparison. The strife will not be long. If we will endure, and if we will fight the battle, we will receive the crown and reign with him. That's one of my great favorite things about 2 Timothy. Paul's about to die, and he's encouraging Timothy. He says, I remember your tears. Fight the good fight. I know you are upset about me right now, but endure. Because if you endure, you reign with Christ. That's still true today. So, as Dudley Tang said, let us all stand for Jesus. Let's all be devoted to him. Let's keep in mind that we are soldiers in the Lord's army. As many of us who have been enlisted, and perhaps you have not enlisted in the Lord's army by obeying the gospel, I want you to know that there is a battle going on. That it is about a choice between an eternity of paradise or an eternity of torment. And there is no comparison between those two things. But if you choose an eternity in paradise, it will come at great cost to you here and now. We need to stand for Jesus. We need to sacrifice our lives in the grave of baptism, arise to fight the war against sin, don our uniforms not because they are pretty, not because we might get a shiny medal, but because we'll receive something imperishable. Because we will be glorified in that wonderful day. We're going to sing, Am I a Soldier of the Cross? Think about that. And if you are not, you need to become one if you hope for an eternity in heaven. Make your choices together. Stand and sing.